Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
For nearly 40 years, Dr. Gordon C. Haber has literally followed in the footsteps of the talk-lapped wolves, as will be obvious as we continue our special edition of the Wildside News. This is a special tribute to the memory, or future, we do not know which for now, of the legendary talk-lapped tribe of wolves here on your Voice of the Earth, the Wildside News. You have very strong feelings about the intelligence of the wolf, even as it relates to dogs. And help us understand the differences that you feel are important.
You think of the most intelligent, expressive, emotional dog you've ever known, and I'll tell you that it's just nothing but an average wolf. I mean, they're so far head and shoulders in their intelligence above even most intelligent dog, you know, that they're fascinating creatures in terms of their complex, highly advanced social behavior, social organization, but they're every bit as interesting, or at least comparably interesting, in terms of their individual intelligence. And it goes even further than that. One of the other things, I think the third thing that has impressed me so much over the years about wolves is their unbelievable sensory abilities and physical abilities. Their eyesight is second to none. I remember once watching, here were a bunch of sheep, white mountain sheep, sound asleep on a white snowy slope where it just been fresh snow the night before, and these wolves picked them out from 8 miles away on another mountain, could see them, and they went straight to them and chased them, ultimately caught and killed one. But they picked these sheep out. The sheep were sound asleep, not moving a bit from 8 miles away. Their olfactory abilities are unbelievable. I've found over the years in my study that about half of their winter diet by weight comes from animals that are already dead. They're tremendously efficient scavengers. A lot of moose and sheep and things die from cold, stress, and other things in the wintertime, and the carcasses are frozen like cement. But the wolves find these, and they utilize them incredibly, even though they're so hard. But just to give you an example, I remember one striking case of this. I was watching one of my groups of wolves. They were going in one direction, and suddenly they just immediately came to a stop, came to attention. Their ears went up. They just obviously detected something, and they immediately turned in a 90-degree direction with the wind now, and immediately started making a beeline 90 degrees off their established line of travel in this new direction. And I wondered, what the hell is going on here? My pilot and I were circling above, watching a couple hundred feet above like we commonly do. What the heck is going on here? And we followed them for another while until they got, I don't know, a few miles away. And immediately at that point, they started digging like crazy through the snow. And they had dug out a crater probably, I don't know, must have been 7, 8, 9 feet deep. And at the bottom of that crater was a moose carcass. They obviously picked that out, buried under 5, 10 feet of snow, with the wind blowing in the wrong direction. I'll never know. But I see them do this kind of thing all the time. It's just unbelievable, their capabilities. You have to see it to believe it. It's just like, it just can't be. One of the other things that really impresses me is their physical abilities. These are the most magnificent physical specimens that you could ever imagine. I mean, especially here in this area, in Denali, they're running up and down these 4, 6, 8, 9,000-foot mountains and peaks regularly. I mean, they're commonly up, travel along high ridges all winter long. That's where they are most of the time, in fact. I remember once, it was just a couple of years ago, where we were watching them. They picked up some sheep in the distance on a high ridge, and they started running after them, and they climbed the opposite slope at a run. You know, they got up, I don't know, it's probably close to 6,000-foot-high ridge top. And they got up that, and the sheep had already run down the other side and were running for the next mountain. But these wolves, as they went up over the top of this ridge, they didn't miss a beat. They never slowed down a bit. And the ridge, now you got to picture this. It's a knife ridge, maybe, I don't know, 5 feet wide on the top. They had just run up, this 6,000-foot ridge from the one side, and now the other side was like a 60 to 70 degree pitch. And it was like an avalanche chute. It was hard-packed snow, just like ice. The sheep had already gone down that, and that's not terribly surprising. Everybody knows how sure-footed they are. But these wolves just literally flew right over, there were three of them in the lead, and they literally flew right over the top of this ridge, and without ever slowing down an iota, they went right over the top, and they went down the opposite side, the downhill side now. And they did this stiff-legged, like they were skiing. And they just literally zipped. They were probably doing 50, 60, 70 miles an hour. They zipped down that several thousand feet to the next, to the, you know, that opposite slope. And then at the bottom, they just kept running.
Talk about their range. I mean, here we are in Denali. You talk about a wolf, for example, that was 200 miles. It had moved 200 miles in I don't know what period of time, but they really do cover a lot of turf on a regular basis.
Well, yeah, they have established territories. Toklat's established territory, for example, is about 600 or 700 square miles. Toklat, in the earlier years, their territory was even bigger. It was closer to 1,000 square miles. They range within these well-established areas over tremendous areas, and sometimes they'll go 20 miles in a day. But, you know, other times they'll stay in the same area for a few days. Now, the summer half of the year, they have fixed bases, den sites and rendezvous sites, from May through the end of September or October. And that's primarily because the young are just too small to travel regularly yet, and so they provision them at fixed sites. But as soon as the young are able to travel regularly, then they just abandon these sites, and the rest of the year they're just moving continuously within their large territories. But now, in addition to that, they have this extremely interesting behavior. I call these extraterritorial forays, where they just, without warning, completely unpredictably, they just suddenly leave their established territories and take off, and they may go a few miles outside the territory, the whole group, and maybe just for a day or two come back, or they may go out for 2 or 3 weeks and go 100 miles away and then come back. Now, these are very different than dispersals. Dispersals, you know, that's pretty routine in wolf society, too, where animals, certain animals, young animals, some of them 2, 3 year olds, just take off and they just never come back. I mean, they go hundreds of miles away, find new mates, and have new, establish new groups. But I'm talking about behavior where the entire group takes off unpredictably and then comes back. So you're right, they move over tremendous areas on a regular basis, and then even more impressively on these occasional, very unpredictable extraterritorial forays. Just 2 days ago, another group, just to the west of Toklat, hell, they went clear across the Alaska range, and I had a hard time finding them. They were, when I found them, they were clear south of the Alaska range. That's on the totally opposite side of North America's highest mountain range, and when my pilot and I finally found them, they were coming back from God knows how far. We were able to track them, snow track them back a ways, but they had obviously been on some distant foray for maybe up to a week, and they were coming back over the top of a 6 or 7 thousand foot high glacier. You know, I hope they made it back at least, because there's a lot of crevasses in that glacier. But
you keep talking about being able to find these wolves. Let people know how you're actually doing that. You spend a lot of time in the air.
Now, in the winter time, it's all by aircraft radio tracking, where they wear radio collars, and usually one or two wolves per group that has a radio collar, and you track them with radio telemetry. In the summertime, I continue to fly, you know, at least a few times a month, but most of the work in the summer is on the ground. I go hiking into the den sites on a regular basis every other day or so, and watch their behavior as closely at these dens, usually at least a couple hundred yards away. I don't want them to know I'm present because I want them to behave, other than in response to me. I want to observe their natural behavior. That's kind of the routine. A lot of flying year-round, especially in the winter, and an awful lot of ground observation. Toklat has been the main group that I've observed on the ground as well as the air for 40 years, and I don't know what, it's going to be pretty quiet in their established den site this year, I'll tell you.
One of the reasons that these recent developments have been so significant, because you actually have been able to track daily, hourly movements, and that has been such a valuable resource in terms of really understanding their behaviors, and now that's gone.
That's right. That's one of the, if not the most important values, certainly one of them. It's very rare in the annals of sociobiology and behavioral ecology that anybody's been able to follow an established family lineage of any species in the wild for that long and get such a complete record. I don't have a complete record of them, but I got a darn good stream of information for 40 years. You know, I don't know what's going to happen from here on. There was still six young. There's still six young are still around, but all the important information has now been lost. I mean, in terms of traditions of this group, the alpha male carried that in his head, what was left of information that had been transferred socially over the generations. These young ones don't have much of that. I mean, most of the six that are there now, I mean, they were just born last May, and the first time they were even allowed to travel away from the den site was in September, so they clearly don't have much knowledge of the little intricacies of the territory and some of the specific hunting methods the group could use and all those kinds of things. So that's what I mean when I talk about the Toklat family lineage. It's not just the individuals themselves. It's all that accumulated learned information in the form of traditions and other related behavior that differs even from neighboring groups and the way they specifically are using this 600 or 700 square mile area, that's gone.
The question that that raises from my perspective, which I find fascinating, is obviously, you know, when you take a wolf that has 6 or 7 years worth of life and experience and traveling around, they have a terrific, it must be like a map in their head of sites and places, and they somehow impart that through their experience to their progeny. And that becomes lost when that alpha male and alpha female in this particular case are gone. All that knowledge about that place is no longer available to those young.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, they learn it by following these individuals, and of course they're not around to follow anymore. I mean, ultimately these young would have learned most of those little nuances themselves just by watching and following. It's not taught deliberately. Well, most of it isn't. I've seen some examples of teaching, but usually it's just a matter of the young just watching and following and learning. You're right. First it was the alpha female. She had been around since 1998 when she was born. This new male, as I said, showed up in 2001, so he'd been there for 4 years, and just being with her all that time, I mean, I was confident, I'm satisfied from having watched him in detail, that he pretty well knew the area, knew all these little, or at least most of the little nuances in the spatial traditions and some of the other traditions. But there's just no way that, other than by just pure coincidence, that the young that are there now are going to pick up most of this. I mean, they'll pick up some of the highlights, all right, but most of the really refined things, that's all gone. And that's the biggest tragedy of all here. And, you know, even the National Park Service itself just poo-poos all of that. Says, well, we still got wolves around. Oh, they'll learn what they have to survive and all that. Well, sure.
It's sort of like sending someone out on a journey without a map.
Well, and it's also just part of the natural scheme of things there in the park. It's not a question of how successful their journey will be. Sure, they'll find other ways to make that journey and survive. And that's the Park Service's argument now. My argument is that, yeah, there's different ways to make the journey, but only one of them was natural, and that was what was going on until we completely changed it all with a major set of human action. But what's so important is the natural, I emphasize the word natural, underlying interplay of events and changes has now been completely substituted with a bunch of human-caused things. But you've really changed the whole set of underlying ecological relationships and important things like traditions. So that, and you know, in a sense, when your concern is only for how many animals will be left, that's kind of the thing that you should be worrying about if you're a zookeeper, if your interest is in maintaining a nice zoo. But if you're managing a national park, it should be just the opposite. It should be that those more basic things, those more refined things, including things like traditions and whatnot, which are clearly lost now.
What I think is important, and I would appreciate your perspective on this, is what really did happen. I mean, these wolves were killed. They were killed,
sure.
some through hunting, some through trapping. What is the value,
sure,
in these animals? Are we supposed to just throw all of this away for the sake of I don't know what?
The most important wintering area to the Denali Park ecosystem is primarily outside that Northeast Park boundary. It's a traditional caribou wintering area, and it's unique because it has some unusual wind patterns that result in less snow accumulating there. And so it serves as kind of a magnet to caribou from the area, and also moose in really deep snow winters because it's easier foraging with less snow. So in a lot of winters, you get a higher concentration of caribou and sometimes moose in that area. And so that, in turn, serves as a magnet to wolves from surrounding areas. As I say, they leave their established territory sometimes, and this is one of them. And of course, the established territory of a couple of these eastern groups just barely goes into that unprotected area. And right now, the protected area bisects the traditional wintering area. So, you know, I mean, the wolves and caribou and everything, they don't know where that line is. It's just an imaginary map line, and they just keep going right across it. But all the trappers know where it is, and hunters, and they line up literally in the winter and nail these wolves when they come across. And it's not just the wolves that we're talking about. It's about half the groups of wolves in the park. Some of them come from 60, 70, 80 miles away for varying periods each winter to hunt in that area. So they're getting hit, and we have not succeeded, unfortunately, in getting the full protection we need there, just as a buffer zone where nothing else would be affected except wolf hunting and trapping. I've been in the forefront of trying to get that area protected, and the biggest opposition, or at least as much opposition to that, has come from the National Park Service here in Denali as anybody from the state. And partly for political reasons. You know, the Park Service likes to get along with the locals, most of whom don't like wolves, and you don't want to be seen if you're a wolf lover if you work for the Park Service up here. And then there's just a lot of bad science behind it, too.
Why do you think that wolves engender such split feelings?
There are a lot of reasons for that, but, you know, one of the main ones is there's a lot of, as far as I'm concerned in this business, there's a lot of scientific backwardness. And if you really want to know what I think, and this view, incidentally, about populations that we talked about earlier, and a lot of biologists think populations are all that you got to worry about. You don't have to worry about these individual groups. Well, when you hold that view, of course, then you don't worry about things like protecting a group of wolves like Toklat. Even though they're correct that there's usually about 35 to 40% annual turnover in most wolf populations due to dispersal as well as death, it's a much different kind of distribution of the deaths than in human hunting and trapping and wolf control. In the natural circumstance, typically in a well-established group of wolves, the wolves that are lost each year to death and dispersal come from primarily from the low-ranking end, the younger end of the group. Whereas, as was clearly demonstrated here just the last few months, I mean, it's human impacts, especially aerial hunting and wolf control operations, but also ground trapping, as we just found out here, can easily take out a lot more of the high-ranking key individuals, a lot more of them at one time than would ever be lost under any reasonable natural scenario that anybody could imagine. And that makes all the difference in the world. And so what I concluded is that when it's human-caused killing, human-caused deaths, because the deaths are distributed much more so among these key individuals, that you can start to see major changes, social changes and other kinds of changes in a group of wolves or a population, even though the numbers might remain about the same. And there are obviously a lot of biologists around who disagree with me, so folks, if you're there listening, let's see you rebut what I said there, and then I'll follow up with a reply to that, and we'll see where it all ends up. There is a more basic reason, perhaps, why people have always had problems with wolves, and or think they do anyhow, and that may go back way into our early evolution. At one time, I'm sure wolves are probably significant competitors and or predators predators on humans before we had very good weapons, and you know, it was probably pretty adaptive for a long portion of our early evolutionary history to fear wolves. But that's, you know, not clearly the case anymore, and I suppose it still resides in our genes somewhere, some inclination in that direction.
Some theories would suggest that humans and wolves have forged this alliance because in many respects we communicate so directly in the same way. We make eye contact, our body language is very similar in a lot of cases. We're verbal and nonverbal at the same time, and also that the wolves, with you talked about their extraordinary capacities to hear and to sense, that the humans actually used them because they were such incredible warning systems about potential dangers.
You make another good point here, and that is that there are some similarities, can be some similarities in the way different, entirely different species find solutions to the same basic ecological problems. And, you know, there are many people, and a scientist, and I'm at least some scientists, and I'm one of them, who think that wolves probably provide a pretty good model for what early human social systems look like, you know, relatively small, slow predators that are forced with the need to subsist largely on much physically superior prey animals. And the solution to that is to outwit these prey animals with sophisticated cooperative hunting techniques, which, of course, requires sophisticated social organization. One of the best examples I can think of is between wolves and wild hunting dogs in Africa, completely different species. But yet, they both kind of are relatively small, slow predators and faced, again, with the problem of subsisting largely on physically superior prey. And they do that, they overcome that obstacle with very sophisticated social organization. In fact, it's unbelievable how similar, right to the last details, social organization of wild hunting dogs in Africa is with social organization of wolves, at least the ones I'm studying.
You know, the Toklat pack has had threats before to their survival, but they've managed somehow always to come through. I've heard in the past they've gotten down to as few as two members. But quite honestly, do you feel that this is the end of the Toklat?
Well, that was, you know, was there watching it all when that happened, and the guy was studying them then, too. And I can tell you, all the difference in the world between then and now is what happened then and what happened now. And there was a complete reproductive failure, the only one I've ever recorded in that group, no pups at all produced, due to the loss of the second ranking pair. As of spring 98, there were two left in that group, a male and a female, a young adult male and young adult female, and then they regenerated the group. Now, this situation here, the only wolves left in the territory right now are just six animals. Most of them, except for maybe one or two, are pups that were born in May of this past year. Here now we got six young that are just suddenly bang like that by themselves without the benefit of any of that past accumulated information. It's a very different situation.
Now, of the six that are remaining, are any of them collared?
No.
So to a large extent, you really lost your connection with this.
Well, and it would have be important to have that just to see what the heck happens to them. But the Park Service refused to collar them. They were going to put a collar on that small group of pups, and then suddenly I think they just thought to themselves, well, do we want to have this information about things that are going to happen to them? Do we want that all over the place? Do we want to listen to this for another indefinite period? Easier not to. They're unexplained decision, just all of a sudden not to do it.
We haven't just lost another, or an alpha male and an alpha female. We've lost a lot more. Tell us what that is that we've really lost at this point now, since they're gone.
Well, we've lost, as I've been saying all along, just an incredible scientific opportunity to learn something more about the characteristics of, a lot more about the characteristics of a successful vertebrate society. And we've lost a group that has provided just unbelievable viewing opportunities and photographing opportunities for visitors to Denali National Park. Maybe more than that, we've lost something that, the kind of thing that really I think is what makes the Earth such an interesting place to be on. I mean, anytime you've got any kind of creature or group of creatures that have been around so long and represent so much history, just thinking about what they've stored away or what they've accumulated and the knowledge they have and all that kind of thing, to me enriches my environment when I know there's those kind of things running around. I had the same feeling years ago here in Alaska when I read that a bowhead whale had been killed by native subsistence hunters off the northwest coast of Alaska in their power boats and radio communication and all the rest. It turned out that whale was 150 years old. It was aged, I guess, and thought to myself, well, I understand, why the natives are hunting them and all that stuff, but my God, look what we've deprived ourselves of. I mean, just knowing there's a creature out there that has 150 years of history and stored away and gone through that much history, to me at least, it greatly enriches the planet knowing there's those kind of things around, and it's just hard for me to swallow watching something or hearing about something like that, or in the case of Toklat, watching something like that getting blown away for, I suppose there are good reasons in some people's minds to do it, but to me they're pretty superficial and frivolous.
Well, you're a scientist who is prepared to talk about the sense of wonder. I think that is what is distinguishing your passion for this pack of wolves. How can we help that scientific community embrace and feel comfortable with talking about the sense of wonder?
To me, that's the most important prerequisite for being a good scientist. It's having that sense of wonder, and it just, you don't see it much in that many people in this business anymore, and I'm sad about that, frankly. It's missing, and the way most of the biologists that I know up here do their wolf observations, they're pretty much quickie little locations from pretty high up in the air, virtually no groundwork, and it's not surprising they don't appreciate these things, but how any good scientist could not be just literally enthralled. I avail myself of the modern technologies too, aircraft and radio telemetry, but I also get out on the ground a hell of a lot, and that's where you really get the feel for them. Or even when you're in the air, stay around and watch them circling for an hour or more straight like I commonly do. You don't get that from a 5-minute or 3-minute quickie little location going to the next one and, recording your data sheet just where they were and go on. So that's really missing, and it's too bad because that's the most important ingredient of all. Without that sense of wonder, that just seems to be rare now. I'm just pessimistic about where we're going. And that's maybe the key thing that's underlying the way wolves are being treated in Alaska now. They're treated like vermin. There's about 1,500 a year that are killed every imaginable way here in Alaska. There's formal aerial wolf control going on now over an area the size of Maine in Alaska, if you add up all the areas. And that's all coming from biologists. It originates with biologists in the field. That's where these wolf control programs are coming from. It's not coming from politicians or political pressure from on top, filtering down to these guys in the field that are therefore being forced to do things they don't want to do. It's not that way at all. That's the common wisdom, but I know because I'm out there and I rub shoulders with these guys. It's just the opposite.
Totally agree with you. It happens in, quote-unquote, the environmental community, where you go to an event and if you start talking a little bit too much about the spirit of the animal, the sense of beauty, there's going to be some within that group who look at you as if you're weird, as if there's something kind of strange. For those of us who get it and have that connection with animals and feel that, it's as real as anything. It's part of, as a scientist, I feel it, I know it, I sense it. I somehow we need to bring that into the sciences.
Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of good scientists in this business, certainly in the lower 48, a lot of good wildlife scientists. But here in Alaska, I'm sorry to say, at least the people that deal with wolves and wolf ungulate systems, I am not impressed. And I'm not bashful about saying so, and I've made my feelings pretty clear to the individuals that are in the business up here, and it's only because I'm watching them destroy something that I love and that I think is very valuable to the world. It's not that I'm just choosing arbitrarily to give them a hard time. It's just that I'm watching people doing things here over and over again, making the same stupid mistakes and doing the same things over and over again that are destroying some things that I love and that others, I think, a lot of other people love. And if we're ever going to change that, I feel I have an obligation to try to point out where the problem is originating. I have been convinced for a long time, based on being out there right in the middle of it all, that it's coming from biologists in the field, just like most people assume the National Park Service is representing their interests with wolves in Denali. I'm sorry, in Alaska, that is not the case. The Park Service is doing a great job in the lower 48, in places like Yellowstone, where they got the highest quality kinds of things, management research going on, you can imagine, but it is not the case up here, and that's just very, very sad, and people have to understand that. That's the only way it's ever going to change.
If people want to learn more about what you're doing and actually, from this point on, follow what happens in this emerging story, what's a good way for them to do so?
My funding comes from an organization back east called Friends of Animals. Of all the people that I know of and all the organizations that I know of that are trying to do something about lousy situation wolves are facing up here in Alaska, there's no organization that's doing more than Friends of Animals, and particularly the president, Priscilla Farrell. She's absolutely just wonderful.
That website, by the way, is friendsofanimals.org. And you can easily go there, and they have links to the story and others. Well, Dr. Haber, I want to thank you for adding your voice to the Wild Side News. I hope we have a chance to talk again.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
From honeybees to wolves, giant black bass to whales, the war on wonder continues. We must speak up. We must stand up and reclaim our right to celebrate in the church of the wood and the wave and the wind and the wonder. For few can deny, these are the greatest gifts the universe has yet to know. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet next time here on the Wild Side News.